Call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
All right, so we're having a bit of problem getting Rachel on the phone. It seems to be just my luck. So what I'm going to do instead is we're going to get you talking about tertiary funding right now. Okay, so there we go.
The Minister for Education, Chris Hipkins, has announced a $31.7 million boost into the tertiary education sector, which the government says will increase the quality of lifelong learning opportunities. It comes after a budget which saw no extra money for tertiary institutes. The Tertiary Education Union have welcomed the announcement, saying the increase will help to stabilise the sector, whilst essential work is done to reform it and the way it is funded. I had a chat this morning with Sandra Gray, she's the National President of the Tertiary Education Union, about why this funding injection was so important, and started by asking her what this announcement actually means for tertiary institutes.
Well, look, we've seen a major announcement that the government is going to reprioritise some funding that was sitting with the Tertiary Education Commission back into our institutions. So it totals around $37 million. What it really means is that every institution has got a little bit of money for inflation-proofing to keep up with the rising costs of running our institutions. That's really big for staff and students.
What areas will see the biggest benefit, do you think?
Well, I think the main thing about this inflation-proofing is that institutions can back away from what has been a series of major change proposals, cutting courses, cutting programs, and getting rid of staff, because the underfunding had resulted in them having to cut costs. So now we've got a stabilisation of funding for the year while we all have a chance to talk about what the funding needs to look like going forward. And that's something that students and staff need to be absolutely a part of, and, you know, that we've been working very hard with the Labor-led coalition to make sure happens.
Will students see a tangible improvement in their education, or is it sort of going to be background improvements that over a long term might see, you know, noticeable changes?
Well, I think the thing that students are going to see is actually going to be quite minimal, unfortunately, because this is just a stabilisation. I mean, it's significant in that we hopefully will see our institutions saying, OK, we can take a breather from the very constant change that's been going on. And certainly, you know, for students at the University of Auckland, at the University of Otago, at a range of places, there have been massive restructurings which have disrupted, you know, their programs of learning, their study, the space that they spend time in daily. And I think if we can see less of that happening because of the government stabilising the funding, that would be a really positive thing for the students and, of course, a massive and positive thing for our members and for the staff working in the sector.
You sort of hinted at it there, but there's been a lot of talk recently about library closures and staff layoffs and that kind of thing. Is this money going to prevent these sorts of things from happening?
I would hope that our institutions are able to say, look, we can take a breather from that work. The government has a major program of reform on. This money gives us some stabilisation. It does mean our institutions can keep up with the rising cost of running the institutions. It does cost more every year to run institutions. The prices of everything they use, the wages of staff do go up, and that's only right because staff have to keep up with their own cost of living increases. So, you know, I hope that they now look at this money and go, great, we can step back from constant change, which is really disruptive for students and, of course, has a major impact on people's lives. We can actually sit down and work out a long-term strategy. But there has to be a willingness from the senior leadership to do that. There has to be a willingness for them to actually sit down and talk properly with staff and students rather than just making hasty decisions and, you know, having a negative impact on our lives.
So this is overdue, you would say?
Look, we have seen flatline funding for 9 years. So for the last 9 years, the previous government put no additional funding into the tertiary education sector. What we've seen with the Labor-led government is they've put money in for students, which has been a welcome relief. Not enough. It's still very hard to be a student. It's still very hard to study. It's still very expensive. And the daily cost of living is still very high. But, you know, there has been a little bit of a movement in that direction. And it signals a willingness of this government to care about student wellbeing. I think for staff, this is a welcome relief from year on year, cuts to budgets, cuts to their working, you know, their working conditions in real terms, in terms of their salaries. You know, we've struggled to make sure those salaries actually match the commitment they put in overall to this sector. So here's hoping the senior leaders of our institutions don't look at this money and say it's for them to do more things with at a management level, that they look at students, they look at the staff who are at the front line and really do pay attention to the needs of, you know, the people who are most important, the people who work and study in the institutions.
What should happen from here going forward? Is it simply a question of more money being injected into the tertiary sector, or is there something else that needs to be done?
We've actually asked the government alongside a number of institutional leaders for a funding review. He's agreed in principle. We're waiting for the details. We need to look at the whole system. There is a problem with the amount of money going in. There is no doubt about that. You can't have the same funding going in for 10 years and expect the same thing to be coming out and the same quality to be coming out. We've had a massive reliance on international student fees to prop up our domestic institutions. The government's looking at that. We need to be round the table as staff and students, but also the public needs to look at our institutions and say, what do we want for, you know, our kids, for our partners, for our you know, for our communities, and say, what sort of funding do we need to put in and where? Because, you know, while we're seeing cuts to courses and universities, when you look out at the ITPs, the polytechnics, a whole lot of communities have no provision now because of cuts to funding. So we need to really think as a community, what do we want our students to get? What do we want our communities to get? And how do we make sure they get them? How do we divide up the pie? And how do we make sure there is actually enough money right there so that everybody can get the type of education they have a right to get?
Right, of course. In the most recent global rankings of universities, a number of New Zealand universities slipped down. Do you think funding could have been behind these drops in rankings?
What we've seen over the last few years is a drop in the international rankings of universities in New Zealand for a few, and that is because other countries are spending more money overall on their education system and they're rising in the rankings. But our institutions, one of the things that they've cut is actually some of the things that make it a university a good place to be. They've cut some of the support services for students, and they've reduced things like tutorials, small group teaching. They've reduced the number of lectures in some courses overall. And that has a real impact on the quality and what students say about the quality of provision. So, you know, the funding has made a direct impact, and it's making a direct impact on the institutions as a whole. And we need to care about that. I mean, we need to care about it because you as students really do deserve the best education possible. That is only possible when all taxpayers commit to supporting a quality tertiary education system. And like I say, we've seen that in other countries. It's time that New Zealanders really took a hard look at it and said, we want the best for our students.
So those rankings might go up then?
Well, what I would hope is that we would see a range of things change, that we genuinely would see accessibility for students, that anyone who, you know, had a desire to get a quality education could find a place to study. The second is that students internally were saying really positive things, that it would affect the rankings overall. But also the other thing, I guess, from my perspective, is that staff wellbeing would go up. We've seen a real decline in the wellbeing of staff. We have a really high stress level in amongst the staff in the sector, higher than most other professions. So the last survey we did, on a scale of 1 to 10, staff said their stress was at a 7. It's a 5.4 average for New Zealand. So there's a real problem in our sector in the wellbeing of our staff and students. I hope that as we get the funding model right, we actually do alleviate some of that stress. We make them better places to study and work, because in terms of wellbeing, staff conditions of work, students' conditions of learning, we're all in it together. We really do need to see a difference made by the whole country.
Yeah, and I can say certainly from a student perspective that in the last couple of years, I've most definitely had a lot less tutorials and these big group things with basically just another lecture, and attendance rates just drop because you don't get that close interaction with tutors or lectures that you'd kind of expect, I think.
Well, I think that's one of the things that we do need to be talking about, because one of the cost-saving measures that people have been doing is cutting the small group teaching, but also putting things online solely. And actually, teaching's a human endeavour. It's about a connection between the teacher and the student. It's about ako, that backwards and forwards, the teaching and learning that we all get. We need that back in our sector. We need to focus on teaching and learning and on quality research in universities, not on can we balance the books right, you know, have we got the best branding, have we got, you know, the kind of the rankings, actually, even to my mind. We need to concentrate on making sure these are places where people really want to be, where there is that ARCO, that teaching and learning, where we're all getting something out of it. And a lack of money has not allowed our institutions to focus on that. They've actually focused on the wrong things. They've focused on the budget rather than the people.
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
Hi, Rachel. How you going?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm pretty good, pretty good. Sorry, I don't think I let you know that Kelly is not on this week.
I think I've figured that out.
Yeah, it's good. There's a little bit of an accent change there.
Yeah, that's true.
Bill has passed recently the Espionage and Foreign Interference Bill. What has kind of been the discussion about that over in Australia?
Well, a lot of people aren't very happy. It passed, I think, last night, and the aim of the bill is essentially to prevent foreign interference and update our national security laws, sort of based on, I guess, the fear that's come from the Cambridge Analytica stuff in the UK and in the US to make sure that no one's interfering with our elections, and also because there's a bit of a paranoia against Chinese influence in our region. But a lot of people are saying that there's a lot of stuff that's been put in this that is rushed and that has the power to really affect things like journalism and protesting.
Yeah, one of the things, the quotation, harm the government's interests, that's quite vague and potentially damning. Sounds like something out of a dystopian novel.
Yeah, it's quite scary, because they are saying essentially that, well, really anyone who's considered to have some kind of foreign influence in their business, so a media organisation that has some sort of foreign backing, or a charity or advocacy group that's got some sort of foreign backing, will have to deal with these laws. So things like reporting on breaches of international law by the government could be illegal. So whistleblowers, as long as they can find some kind of international connection, a whistleblower could be put in jail simply for reporting something that was in the public interest, just because they can basically say it was influenced by a foreign nation.
Mm. And there's concerns about peaceful protests being criminalized potentially?
Yeah, so there's a sabotage section of the bill that basically says that advocacy groups or protesters can be jailed for blocking public access to places. So if they, it's, I guess, the sort of old chain yourself to a tree kind of thing, in some situations, if that's going to harm Australia's interests, they could end up in jail for that as well.
Wow. And so moving on, Australia has figured out that every child in a detention centre in the Northern Territory is Indigenous.
Yeah, this is a bit shocking, but then you also, knowing the Northern Territory, it's not overly surprising. The Northern Territory is sort of, I guess, at the top of Australia. It's a very large region with a very small population, and a lot of that population are Indigenous. And it's been in the news over the past few years because of mistreatment of children in detention. And this week we found out that of the children in detention in the entire Northern Territory, every single one of them is Indigenous, which is really saying quite a lot about how we're managing Indigenous children and children with disadvantage in that area.
Mm. And so that's a very densely populated Indigenous area. How much do you think that is playing into that?
It would be a bit, but I think at the end of the day, it comes down to the fact that Indigenous people, by and large, are the most disadvantaged people, and children, especially if they are struggling with their parents, or if they don't have parents, they sort of have to rely a little bit on people around them and the government to make sure that they're going through life well. And I think what's been said is that people who work in detention centres, they're just not, or people who work for children with disadvantage are not doing their job properly, and there needs to be a lot more influence by the local Indigenous communities taking care of their own children instead of the, I guess, Western government coming in and trying to take over without true knowledge of the situation.
Mm. And so there has been a wave of abuse directed at an Australian female World Cup commentator for pronouncing names too well. What is that about?
This one's quite a disappointing one. Lucy Zelich is the female commentator for the, I guess, the Football World Cup. And she's a Croatian-Australian, and it's on a broadcaster that has a big influence to supporting multiculturalism in Australia. And so Lucy's put a lot of effort into making sure that the foreign names, the European names, the South American names are all pronounced correctly. And people have really been angry about that, because in Australia we have, I guess, a habit of anglicising names and just making it really easy for people to just change people's names to suit them. And for some reason, they seem to believe that this is what a Croatian Australian should be doing on our television.
Mm. Is that just some blatant racism we're seeing coming up, or?
In some ways. And it has sort of started a conversation this week where multicultural Australians are coming out and saying, you know, for my entire life, I've had people either willingly or unknowingly mispronounce my name. And it makes a lot of, and it makes me very happy to see somebody going out and putting the effort in. But then other people are also saying that this Lucy's not the first person to do this. We've had male commentators in the past put a lot of effort into pronouncing names correctly, and they've been hailed for it. And the difference here is just that people are still uncomfortable seeing a woman commentate sport on national television.
Yeah, so what is that about? Why do you think people are so uncomfortable about a woman coming in and commentating?
It's interesting. I think it really is something that you just see across the board here. Lucy, she's got a very clear European Australian accent, and things like that in politics as well, and in sport. Everything that a woman does in positions where you wouldn't expect a woman to be just gets that extra level of criticism that you don't usually see when a man does it.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for talking with me. Rachel, we'll be talking with you next week.
No worries.
You have a nice day.
You too.
Bye.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.